Sunstrom Recruitment are the leaders in health and safety recruitment. If you're considering a career change or need to discuss your organisation's hiring, reach out to the team today. We were awarded Recruitment Agency of the Year in Health and Safety in 2023 and are a proud sponsor of Health and Safety Conversations.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome to Health and Safety Conversations. Here's your host, Tom Bourne.
Hi, and welcome to Health and Safety Conversations. I'm your host, Tom Bourne, and with me today is the marvellous Tanya Hallett. Tanya, how are you?
I am very well, thank you, Tom. How are you?
Great. It's a beautiful day in Perth. Great to be alive.
It is. The humidity's gone down today, so yay!
Yeah. I was up in the Pilbara yesterday. It was a mere 39 degrees, so it's a nice change coming back home.
Practically Arctic, isn't it, really?
Yeah, true. All right, Tanya, I know a little bit about you, but for those who are unfamiliar with you so far, can you tell us a little bit about you and your professional journey?
Okay, so look, it's a little bit convoluted, but I'm going to keep it as short and sweet so we don't bore everybody. So I have been a teacher trainer for the last 20 years. So I started teaching and spent 6 years in Japan. Mm-hmm. And that was the first part of my career. And when I came back to Australia, I ended up working from sort of private, beautifully behaved, all girls Japanese high schools to some pretty hard to staff schools in the Perth area. And so I started working in these schools where kids had really significant traumatic backgrounds. There could be a lot of violence. There was a lot of trauma, a lot of mental health issues. Kids were lovely, but very, very unregulated and had a lot of trouble engaging with kind of the traditional classroom atmosphere, I suppose. And I just found that when I worked with those kids, I felt like I was making a lot more of a difference. And it really was so rewarding when you could make a connection with these kids and they'd come to you for sort of help and guidance. A lot of them had incredibly tough homes. And it was really, I felt very important in the respect that we had to be that role model for these kids to come to be their safe place. Because a lot of kids who come from those environments, school is their safe place. That's where they go. And then I became very, very interested in trauma, working with complex trauma and people who suffer with trauma. And when you started to see behavior through a trauma lens, it was just, you could really understand, you could nearly predict what their behavior was going to be and how your response needed to vary to that behavior. So that was really the start of everything. I was there at one particular school for about 10 years, but it became increasingly stressful because there were a lot of fights. Some of them had become incredibly violent. I remember one particular fight where I had two girls really, really, like, it was like a prison fight. They were ripping bunches of hair out of each other's heads. They were kicking, they were punching, they were screaming. I got in the middle and tried to stop the fight, and I got shoved against some cabinets. And then another student of mine actually came in and pushed me out the way and said, "Miss, what do you think you're doing?" She pushed me out of the way of the fight, got in to split up these two girls, and got kicked in the head and had her finger broken. And it was pretty hardcore. And after that particular fight, I was really, really, really shaken up, because it was one of the really, really worst ones I'd seen. And I had to have another student come in and protect me when I felt like it was my job to protect them. So a few incidents like that occurred. I had a student also shove a rock into my mouth. And then I thought, you know what, this is getting a little bit dangerous. After every sort of new instalment, I'd go home and tell my husband about what had happened. And he'd say to me, "Tanya, we've got two small children. What's it going to take for you to get really, really hurt before you decide that maybe this isn't the right thing for you to be doing?" So I went from teaching into doing support work for a while. And again, I went to look after an adolescent who had a very, you know, a severe trauma background and a few other disabilities. And this particular adolescent ended up becoming very violent, and I was doing sleepover shifts with her. And she tried to set fire to the house. She one night really was unregulated and held my head over live electrical wires. I called the while she was throwing, you know, boiling hot water at them, I called the police. They said, "Look, it's a Sunday night in December. It's going to take us about 4 hours. We'll get to you when we get to you." And that night I thought, I'm going to die. I'm not going to get home to see my kids. That's it. This is it. This is where it all ends. And after that incident, I was diagnosed with PTSD. And that was really the start of where things changed from just teaching into me being incredibly passionate about what it is, what's trauma-informed practice. So that's the bit of a convoluted way of saying it. Sorry.
Oh, that's all right. That's all right. It's a very interesting story. I get to tell you, I know people most people I know who've got into the teaching practice, and I know quite a few of them, they've gone into it, and there are certain professions which are all the same like this. Mm-hmm. You go in to help people. You go in to help the kids. And a lot of the time, you leave the industry or the profession, it having changed you instead of you changing the system.
Absolutely.
Your story, can I be honest with you, is not unusual for teachers. I know some teachers who worked in Brisbane in very low socioeconomic areas, and what you're describing absolutely picture perfect. One of the ladies I know, first day there dealing with grade one, she was scratched, she was punched, and she had a chair thrown at her. And this was from grade one.
Yep. If people really knew what was out there in some places, they would be really quite shocked, I think. Really shocked.
The thing also is, I know people who have basically tried to teach and try to help children who are the only way I can say it is fundamentally broken. They're fundamentally broken because of the trauma that they've been exposed to or lived through. And I've had to say to a few people, and it's a very cruel thing, you can't save them all. I don't think you can. And I think it's heartbreaking for people who go into these professions with the absolute best intentions and to see, they walk away a bit disillusioned.
It's really tough, because at the end of the day, you will not save them all. You do your best, and that's all you can do. But it's very difficult when the actual systems that are set up are no systems are working in an integrated way to support each other. And that's one of the biggest issues. You've got your education system, when really these are massive social issues that these kids are facing, and they were broken long before they came to us, and we're doing the best we can to fix them. And you will help some and you won't help others. That's true. But it is a really, really tough. It is an incredibly tough job. It can be really rewarding, but it can also be incredibly stressful and draining. Absolutely.
Yeah. I sometimes wonder for people going into these professions if they should, after 12 months, perhaps realistically go, what am I actually hoping to achieve in this area? Is it that they be straight A students or this, or are you just trying to make them socially and civilly functional when they get older?
Yeah, that, and you know what, for a lot of the time that I worked, that, and I still work in some more difficult schools, but sometimes that is absolutely what you try to focus on. How can I get this person as ready as possible for the world, for the workforce? And that's probably where what I'm doing is coming into it, because I realized that I was working with these kids. They were leaving me. They were going into the workforce because they were ready to be apprentices or they were ready to be trainees. But the trauma that they had was following them, and the people, the employers that they had, didn't necessarily know how to deal with them either. And that's sort of what's been the driving force for this, is that there's a massive gap from where these kids go from school, where they are receiving pastoral care from us, to going to a workplace where they've got bosses who don't have this training and experience.
I know I'm dwelling on education a little bit at the moment, but that's because it's an interest to me. But I sometimes think that society has now taken responsibility of parenting away from the parents and pushes it onto, first of all, the primary school teachers,
the high school teachers, and then the secondary teachers.
And then we find in the vocational education sector, we're also left to pick up the pieces.
Absolutely.
I think it's fundamentally flawed.
It is fundamentally flawed, but it's sort of like the genie's out of the bottle. How do you put it back in? And so because that's sort of the situation we've got, it's how do we best work within it? But you're absolutely right. I mean, what's happened is the buck's been passed for so long and, you know, stuff rolls downhill, doesn't it?
That's right. Just on that, how did you cope? I mean, you mentioned you were diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. How did you actually cope at school being exposed to these things? Because we talk about psychologically safe. This is not even psychologically safe. This is not physically safe.
No. And this is the thing, like, I did a Cert 4 in safety a really long time ago, because what had become apparent to me was that safety in teaching was just for some reason being completely disregarded. There's a reason that we have, you know, 50 to 80% of new graduates burning out within 5 years of being in the force, and why there's lots of people that are, you know, the percentages of teachers that are leaving are significant. And this is because there is huge amounts of what you would call basic work health and safety issues that are not being looked after. So a lot of schools are pretty good with physical safety. If you work in the harder to staff schools, physical safety is an issue. So I had a lot of times where I was punched or shoved or definitely felt physically unsafe. Most of the time I knew the relationship with my students would protect me, but sometimes it didn't. When I was pregnant working in those schools, it was even more scary. And there was a time I had walked into the principal and I had said to her, hey, listen, I cannot be in that class. It is unsafe. And she said, you can't tell me what to do. You will go to the class. I've told you, you will go there. And I said, I'm not going in there. It is not safe. So how do you cope? You push back where you can, but for the most part, I think that it's swept under the rug a lot. I don't think the safety of teachers is being looked at nearly as well as it should be. And aside from the physical safety, the psychological hazards in that job are intense. They are horrendous. Psychosocial hazards there. It's shocking. And if they don't do something about it soon, they're not going to have any people left to do the job.
That's true. I don't think it's actually restricted just to teaching. I find any industry where people are in, they've gone in for caring roles. So we've got nursing, ambulance, no offense, prison officers, police.
Yeah, absolutely.
Everyone, they're subject to, no offense, fairly horrific risks day to day. And society's pushback on them is, it's part of the job. What did you expect? Well, I don't know if we'd accept those sort of risks in other workplaces. That just wouldn't be accepted.
No.
So I don't know why society, or a large part of society, seems to think that we either A, shouldn't talk about it, or B, take any action about it, or say that you chose that profession, toughen up, it's yours.
Oh, you're absolutely right. And when I had raised these issues quite a number of times, because I mean, my father, for context, was a pilot for Royal Flying Doctor Service, and my dad has always been a real stickler about safety and processes and the things that exist to keep everybody safe. They exist to keep you safe. And every time I brought up safety and these issues of safety, the response was exactly as you described. Oh, well, this comes with a job, and if you can't hack it, maybe this isn't the right job for you. And I thought, oh my goodness, this is just so unhelpful. And there's a lot of that that exists in a lot of the industries you mentioned, other people that are dealing with a real butt of horrendous stuff that's happening in society, and they are left to deal with it, and they burn out fast.
Yeah. Now, Tanya, I'm pretty ignorant in a lot of things in my life. Trauma-informed practice. Honestly, I don't know too much about the term.
Yes, that's fair enough. You're not the only one who doesn't know much about that term. So it doesn't make you ignorant at all. Trauma-informed practice is, look, it's a buzz. People will call this a buzzword, you know, trauma-informed practice or trauma-informed care. And they'll go, oh, this is a buzzword people are talking about. But what it actually means in a nutshell is that recognizing that a lot of people that you work with or that access your services or that, you know, are in the workplace with you or in schools with you actually suffer from a level of trauma themselves. Like it's quite common. In actual fact, the newest stats say that over a third of the people we have in Australia, of young people, suffer from complex trauma, which I'll sort of explain a bit later, but it's common. This is not an unusual thing. There are a lot of people walking around who have experienced significant trauma, whether that's been a one-off event or whether it's been lifelong of traumatic events. So trauma-informed practice, it's holistic, it's empowering, it's collaborative. It's sort of the way of working with people, understanding that their reactions to certain things that you say or certain things that you do is often a result of trauma, and understanding that it's incredibly important you build relationship first, you build trust first, you have to use emotional intelligence, you have to give people in these situations choice. So that might look like, okay, I understand this is really difficult. Here are the options we have right now. Option A is this, option B is this. Think about it. Which one do you think you would prefer? Because people who've gone through trauma have often gone through trauma because their own power has been taken away from them. So trauma-informed practice is about giving it back to them, giving them collaboration in this, working out what they need to feel safe, and understanding that people's heightened reactions to things are a reflection of the trauma that they've experienced. So it's really important that you make sure that you check your reaction to them so that you don't escalate situations further. So it's a lot of reflective listening and just being really able to communicate in a really empathetic way, and understanding that when someone, you know, flares up and starts getting angry, it's not about you. It's that they probably came to work and their cup was already full. And then something's happened and it's tipped them right over the edge because their cup wasn't empty to begin with. They weren't at baseline when they came to work. They weren't at baseline when they came to school. So, or they've had an incident that's pushed them way past baseline. So when you talk to this person, you have to remember that. And then your reactions need to be empathetic. You need to be trying to, you're using crisis communication skills where you're trying to bring things right down. So that's what trauma-informed practice is. It's a lot about the communication and offering choice and empowerment for that other person.
Okay.
Does that explain it?
Yeah, it does.
Oh, good.
I can see a problem. I can see a little problem, well, at least in my head here. Someone comes to work, as you said, with their cup already full.
Mm-hmm.
Fires off,
mm-hmm.
flares up, whatever you mm-hmm. want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
Chances are in modern workplaces, that person's probably going to find themselves in front of human resources.
Mm-hmm.
Are human resources equipped to understand this?
That's such a good question, Tom. I don't think so. Look, some maybe. There are some people who work in human resources and, you know, working with people, and they're good. They've got good understanding of this, but largely no, because unless you've actually worked within trauma spaces, then this is a really hard, these seem like really simple concepts, but unless someone's explained this to you, it's not simple. And what happens is a situation that could honestly be solved really easily by taking a step back with the communication and by not escalating things further, just by reflective listening some of the time. It gets worse. Things escalate. People lose their jobs, or situations get so much worse because people aren't trained to deal with this. They're really not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I don't believe that your run-of-the-mill human resource people are trained in this either, for the most part. This is quite new. And honestly, I've worked for 10 years in a really intense trauma space, and it was my 10th year when I got any formal training in this. So that's a good indication of how commonly understood this really is.
Okay. Mm. When you were exposed to trauma in the workplace,
mm-hmm.
symptoms, what made you want to go to the doctor and say, I have these problems? Because a lot of people are reluctant to do that. And I'm just wondering, I hate to use the word symptoms, but it's kind of appropriate.
No, it's absolutely appropriate. Yeah.
What sort of symptoms were you suffering that made you go to a doctor?
So what happened to me was, and my case particularly also became a workers' comp case, which is a whole other ball game in itself. But what happened was I had come home after this particular incident, which was where I really did think I would die. And I came home, and what would happen was the first thing I noticed was I was having trouble sleeping. I was exhausted, but I couldn't sleep. And then when I did get to sleep, I would have the most horrific nightmares where I dreamt that I was put back in the situation again, or I was in another situation where my life was threatened and I was trying to say, stop, and no one would listen. And I'd wake up and the bed sheets were covered, like they were wet with sweat. My nightie was wet with sweat. And I also found that I wouldn't even, so I've got small children, and at the time where I was really
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for, but you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Struggling. I was getting up and down to my youngest, because she was about, I think, 2 at the time. And I was getting up and down to her, and I would get up to get her milk or water in the middle of the night, and I would walk past my windows and I was sure I could see the face of the person who'd held my head over these live wires, and I'd have to look again, or you'd be listening for noise, or you'd be walking outside, you'd be just walking down the street and you'd be thinking, oh no, something's going to happen, or a car's going to jump out of nowhere and run me over, or I'd hold on to the kids really tightly being terrified something would happen to them. One of the biggest incidents I had was when I was driving north on the freeway, because I live south, and I was driving north on the freeway and I had to drive past the exit of where this adolescent had lived that I'd helped, and I had to go past that exit and I broke out in a cold sweat in the car, and I was thinking, shit, I'm really not okay. And I'm going 100 on the freeway. And I thought, am I going to have to pull over? Like, am I even safe to keep driving? Like, things like that happened. But the hypervigilance, being terrified something was going to happen, sort of seeing glimpses of things that weren't there, or being sure someone was going to break into my house, or being sure I was going to be stalked, or all these sorts of things happened. And that's when I was sort of like, well, no, this can't be normal. And I'm pretty resilient, and I just was not coping. And I was exhausted.
Is there a real danger that if people aren't diagnosed, they may start to think they're losing their mind?
Oh, yeah, I did think I was losing my mind. I absolutely thought I was going crazy. So when I finally found a really good clinical psychologist, when I was diagnosed, I had been suffering for five and a half months by the time I was diagnosed. Because when I went to my GP initially, she had said to me, and this isn't the GP I've got now, this was another GP. The one I've got now is fantastic. But the one I went to said to me, oh, look, I don't know if you've got PTSD, because really you have to have these symptoms for 6 months before we can diagnose it, which, by the way, isn't true. It's supposed to be about a month. And if it's not better at a month, then you've got a problem. But you're also, when you're also not validated, you're invalidated by the system, and people are saying to you, oh, look, your sense of safety is going to come back in time. You'll be all right. And I'm like, no, I'm not all right. And the real danger is that you do feel like you're going nuts, because it's a real roller coaster. And when I was diagnosed finally by a psychiatrist, it really helped me to see that in the report, because I thought, what is wrong with me? Why am I not coping? What is the matter with me? And my clinical psych, when I was having counseling with her, who's also fantastic, you know, I would say to her, I feel like I'm going crazy. I don't know how many times I said I feel like I'm going crazy. You do think you're going crazy, and you think, what is wrong with me? I've really lost the plot. And there is a real danger that if you're not diagnosed, if you're not given proper help by really, you know, by good medical professionals, then yeah, it's going to get a lot worse. The hole gets deeper the longer you spend in it without getting the right help that you need.
Yeah, I'm not a psychologist or psychiatrist, but I just wonder, eventually, for some people, this might be too much for them to bear, and they may harm themselves in some way.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really common. What I think tends to happen with PTSD is what seems to be common is people are struggling. They either don't get help, or like me, when they ask for help, they're being invalidated or fobbed off the time when they do ask for help, and they will self-medicate. So that's when things like alcohol, drugs, other types of behaviors type, because they're trying to self-medicate. They're not feeling okay, and they're trying to self-medicate. And then I think that very quickly can lead into things like depression and lead into suicidal ideation, or, you know, a suicidal, you know, where people start to go, right, well, that's it. There's no point in me being here anymore. I feel like I've lost the plot. No one really believes me anyway, or I'm not going to seek help, and I don't really know what's wrong with me. And I think it's really quick for that rabbit hole to start.
Yeah. Is it still stigmatized, those who have been diagnosed with PTSD in society?
I think it's still stigmatized in the respect that people who are not, who don't know a lot about mental health, or people who don't know a lot about trauma, will sort of say things like, oh, you know, is it really that bad? Or, I've got PTSD from blah, blah, blah. And it's like, well, no. Or the best response I had was when I explained to my father what was happening, and he said to me, well, you haven't been to war. Why would you have it? And I said, no, Dad. Like, no, that's not. So there is a stigma in the respect that I think people do sometimes look at you like you're weaker. And that can be very tough for people if they're worried about seeking help. And people say things that are invalidating when they say things like, oh, we haven't been to war. This can't be that bad. Like, you should be over this by now. And that's probably the top what 1 to 3 worst things you can say to someone who've got PTSD? Because if they've got it, they've had an experience. Generally, PTSD occurs because you've had an experience that is out of the ordinary. Your life or the lives of those that you care about has been threatened in a way where you really thought it was going to have serious injury or serious consequences. And that's what PTSD is. It's an out of the ordinary event. You thought you were going to die or be severely harmed, or someone you loved you thought was going to die or be severely harmed, or someone that you were with. And you do, it affects your whole sense of safety in the entire world. And the world becomes a bad, bad, bad place. And that's where it starts. And that doesn't have to be war. That could be a car accident. That could be an incident where, you know, where you watch a loved one be hurt. You know, it could happen in any sort of situation. It's more common than people think.
Yeah. All right, Tanya, what exactly are you doing professionally now?
So I still teach, and then I am working on my I'm working on my business development on the side. So I've created my training programs, and I am just in the process of trying to get them out there. So that's what I do. So I teach I still teach, and I still enjoy teaching. I'm also doing my mental health first aid course in a couple of weeks as well. So I'm basically just working on getting these programs out there, getting this training out into the corporate world or into the government world, because I really believe that there's a strong need for that.
Excellent. Now, I note that you also work closely with Indigenous clients.
I do, heaps of Indigenous clients, yep.
I've got to say, I think I've come a long way in my understanding and acceptance of Indigenous culture, because I've got to be quite honest with you. I 15 years ago was very intolerant and very, very ignorant, but I still got a long way to go. Does working with Indigenous clients who are at risk, does that pose any particular challenges for you?
Look, it's understanding. So because I've worked a lot with, worked a lot with Indigenous students the whole time I've been in education, and I work a lot now. My school has a lot of Indigenous students, so I do a lot of work with Indigenous students. It's really important, I find, to build trust with Indigenous clients, because, and it makes perfect sense, because generally there is a distrust for any type of authority figures, and there is a distrust for any type of system hierarchies, and they exist because of, you know, generational trauma that most Indigenous people have suffered through. They have a lot higher risk factors for trauma. You know, 64% of Indigenous young people have got complex trauma, which is really a really, really high. That's double nearly double what the, you know, if you compare it to the general population. They're 8 times more likely to suffer from child abuse. They're 15 times more likely to be involved in the juvenile justice system. So it's remembering that when you're dealing with people with Indigenous clients, you're actually dealing with a whole bunch of other layers of historical trauma, intergenerational trauma, distrust of an entire system. And it does, and you know, generational poverty, all of these things do make everything a lot more complicated. So for me, I've learned a lot about Indigenous culture, but that's from time spent. That is time spent working. That is time spent I have an Indigenous dance group at my school that I put together. It's putting all that time in. It's building those relationships. It's building that trust. I don't think this is a quick process. And when you work with clients who are Indigenous, you're going to have to build the relationship and the trust first before they're going to open up to you and tell you anything. So there is that. There is definitely that layer of complexity.
Yeah. I must say one of the most eye-opening things for me ever, because where I grew up, there's certainly, let's just say, my exposure to anything Indigenous was almost zero. And then when I moved out to northeast West Australia, I'm teaching, I was helping teach a lovely first aid class, and we're talking about people not being able to breathe. And an Indigenous client who said, "Hey, that's exactly right." And I was like, "Oh, okay." He said, yeah, I've had to cut down two of my relatives once they've tried to hang himself. It just,
oh gosh.
That sort of thing's just slapped you in the face, because it's like, this is not what you expect where I came from. And this is a reality.
It is a reality.
In the communities. And a lot of people don't either choose to understand that or want to understand that.
And it's what I find is very difficult, sort of when I have conversations with people who don't work very closely with Indigenous, or they don't know many Indigenous people, and they do have, you know, the media does feed us a definite viewpoint there. And plus people have got their own unconscious bias. But when you really hear stories from people, when you really hear what these people have been exposed to on a daily basis, domestic violence, the abuse, the generational poverty. Like when you have these stories, you sort of go, I mean, stories I've heard where people watch their, you know, one when I was doing an English assignment, I'll never forget one girl, an Indigenous girl, wrote about how her mother had a boyfriend who used to go on ice benders, and one day he dragged her mother across the floor, and they had to lock themselves into the bedroom for 3 days because this guy was so violent and unpredictable, and they ended up having to break out of their window to go and get a neighbor to get help. Like, you know, I remember her writing that in an English story, and it was just like, you know, these are things, this isn't one off, this happens all the time. It happens all the time. And if people understood that, then the way you deal with people is very different, because you can understand why they'd be triggered or distrusting, because all the systems that are set up to support them haven't done so.
The only other group I've seen which, let's say, have institutional trauma like this are some refugees.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's another group.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and some of the things, if you get their trust, that they'll tell you about, are beyond the norm. And yet mostly they're functional day-to-day as you and I, and you wouldn't even know what's bubbling along below the surface. Mm-mm. Okay, psychological safety.
Mm.
It is one of the buzzwords.
Mm-hmm. It really is.
What does it mean to you?
So psychological safety to me is very much providing, so it's providing an environment that is, it's safe. First of all, it's got to be safe for your workplace.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got to be physically safe. It's got to be mentally safe and emotionally safe as well. And what that means is making sure that people's exposure to psychosocial risks is mitigated where possible, or if you can't mitigate the risk, they are being given adequate support to get through what they may have experienced. So things like exposure to traumatic events, there needs to be support there. There needs to be support around realizing that people who are burnt out and stressed out, or putting unrealistic demands on people that they can't meet, or making people do jobs without adequate resources or training, all of these things pose psychosocial risks. In the area of resources, for example, the mining sector, one of my big passions is psychosocial safety around sexual harassment and sexual assault reporting, because that requires a huge amount of training to deal with the response appropriately. You know, creating workplaces where people know that it's not okay to harass people, either sexually harass people or bully people, because that happens consistently. Things like that are really, they take such a massive toll on people from their levels of stress and their mental health. And people can think of this is a buzzword. Oh, everyone's talking about this now. It doesn't matter. So the way I explain it to people is, we're all responsible for making sure people are psychologically safe. If you were at work with someone and they went to weld something and they didn't wear their welding helmet and they didn't wear their protective clothing and equipment, would you stop them and say, geez, I think you might burn your retinas there, that might be a bit unsafe, or would you let them go? And psychosocial safety is exactly the same. It's putting people under pressure or putting them in environments where their stress levels and their levels of trauma are being driven extremely high and then doing nothing about it. It's the same as letting your welder weld without wearing his helmet, without saying, geez, mate, I think that might be a little bit dangerous. Perhaps you want to put your helmet on there.
Yeah.
It's like PPE for your head. That's what this is.
Oh, I love that. I might use that in future because that's a great.
Yeah, it's PPE for your head. That's exactly what it is. And if, you know, you wouldn't want someone to perform a task without wearing their protective equipment. And if you didn't say anything, you know you're not following the OCC Health and Safety Act anyway. But this is the same. I mean, if you're putting people in situations where they're stressed or they're being bullied or they're having a really horrible time or they're being harassed and you sort of go, oh, they'll be all right. That's like letting the welder weld without his helmet.
Yep. All right. A couple of quick questions and we will have to leave it. This has been a great talk, by the way.
Oh, I'm glad. Hooray.
All right. The future for mentally healthy workplaces in Australia, in your opinion, is it likely to get better or are we going to stay pretty much the same?
I do hope that it gets better. I do think the fact that we're talking about it is always the start. So these problems thrive in the darkness. If we shine a light on it, it can't stay there hidden. And if we talk about it and it becomes more normalized to talk about this and more normalized to understand this, then we do have a better safety for psychosocial safety, workplace mental health safety will be better. But we have a huge amount of work to do. There are some amazing programs that are running out. Like, I'm a huge fan of mental health first aid. I think that's really important for that being rolled out to everywhere. I think every workplace should be doing that. Mm-hmm. I think that there is, like in the mining sector, for example, like FIFO Focus are doing some incredible work with, breaking the circuit and some of the courses they're running, which I think are incredibly important for the people that are out on site. But there's a lot to go. There's not a lot of understanding about trauma. And there's not a lot of understanding about trauma-informed practice. And I think that if we are really going to see more improvement in that, there needs to be a significant increase in the training. And people need to also work on being open to listening and open to understanding it and not seeing this as, oh, shit, I've had to put my tools down to come and sit through another bloody training session on bloody mental health and I don't care. And, I hope that the narrative around it changes, because if it doesn't and if the stigma stays, we are not going to make the progress that we really desperately need to. And the statistics of mental health and what it's costing the economy is between $13 to $17 billion a year. Mm. People are, with psychological injury, the average time off is over 16 weeks. Like, it's costing money. So it makes economic sense to invest in this. And it also makes, it's ethically correct to do this. You are going to get a lot more out of your workforce if they are mentally healthy and happy. And it's not, I don't think it's that hard to make that happen. I really don't.
Okay, good. All right. If I'm in human resources, if I'm in a training department, if I'm in a safety team, and I want to talk to you about coming and running a training program, how do I go about doing that?
So you can either contact me on LinkedIn or go to com.au. That's my website. And I will absolutely get back to you and give you any other information that you need.
Okay. Now, I know you've got a young family. Does that include people who are not in Western Australia?
No, my young family here. Oh, you mean people who want to talk to me elsewhere? Yeah, no, that's fine. Absolutely. Look, I'm going to make anything happen here, Tom, because I really am passionate about this and I actually think this is important for everywhere.
Brilliant. Tanya Hallett, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you today. And I look forward to speaking to you again soon.
Thank you so much, Tom. Thanks so much for having me. It was great to chat to you.
Thanks for listening to Health and Safety Conversations with Tom Bourne. Until next time, stay safe. and enjoy the rest of your week.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.